Accession number 8736, rule number 20.
Lord Harding, tape 20.
Well, he went on all day, and I would try to kit them up with all as I had available. And at the end of the day, I remember, well, must have been latish on in the day, I said to him, well, there you are, I've done all I can for you. And then he said to me, well, so you know my name is not Smith. So, well, why the hell didn't you tell me before? He said, my name's Sewell. I got to know him, he was one of my brigadiers afterwards when I commanded him. A very, very good chap. So that's the sort of thing that happens, you know. Anyway, that was that. And then things began to clear up at GHQ. Alexander took over as Sikh Commander-in-Chief. Dick McCrary took over as his Chief of Staff. Auchinleck and Corbett disappeared, and Dawn Smith, they all disappeared. And I was left as Deputy Chief of Staff with the primary responsibility at that time, for the next week or two, of introducing Alexander to the desert. And we formed a small tactical headquarters, and I went with him up to the desert and took him around and introduced him to everybody.
How did you get on with Alexander?
Oh, very well. He's a marvellous chap to work with. He really was. He was. He may have been an enigma, and he may have been some people, the historians now accuse him of being indecisive, which, he had a very different style of command from either Auchinleck or Wavell or Monty, of course. But he could be decisive if it was necessary. No, I got on very well, and I had the highest admiration and affection for him.
How did he differ from their style?
Well, well, to compare Alexander and Monty, for example. Monty operated by clear, calculated reason. Alexander operated much more by instinct. Alexander had an experience of the battlefield at every level, from a platoon commander to being company commander, brigade commander, battalion commander, brigade commander, divisional commander, and so on. He had all the experience, of course, of the Second World War, Dunkirk, and the evacuation there. And he'd been to Burma, he'd been to wherever it was, Mamax, and so on. So he was a very battlefield experienced soldier. But he liked to think that people would offer to his commanders, his subordinates, would automatically do what was right and what was best. And he liked to give them full rein and not intervene unless he had to. In other words, he operated more by remote control, so to speak, than by direct and rigid control, fixed control. Monty was very firm and definite. You do this, you do that, you do that. Alexander said, well, perhaps this is what ought to happen. This is what we ought to do. This might be the best thing, the way in which you and your formation, your army, your corps can contribute most.
He sounds more democratic.
Well, I don't know about... No, he wasn't democratic, but he was more flexible ready to leave the responsibility to his subordinates.
Did he check very carefully, first of all, that he could trust them, though? Did you find that he was quite conscious of the necessity of finding out their sort of caliber?
But I think he was conscious of the different levels of skills and performance of his various commanders. Yes, I think he was conscious of that. It's very difficult to describe, very difficult to put into words the difference between what I call the firm, rigid, inflexible control and the more flexible attitude of Alexander.
These two very different styles, then, did they complement each other, Montgomery and Alexander?
Well, they did. They did to start with. When they both came out to the Middle East, Alexander's commander-in-chief and Monty's army commander, for the first period and up to the certainly up to the launching of the Alamein offensive, they did complement each other. Because in two ways, and I think Monty never gave Alex the credit for what he did in this respect, was that Alex gave Monty a free hand in organizing and in training and in planning. And he gave him a normal, perhaps too free a hand, but he did give him a free hand. At the same time, and Monty, of course, appreciated that at the time. And this, in this sense, they were complementary. At the same time, Alexander stood firmly between Monty and the pressure from Winston and the War Cabinet to launch the offensive at the earliest possible date, before he was ready. Monty was quite determined that he wasn't going to launch his offensive until, and rightly so, until he'd got everything properly prepared. And that was a tremendous thing, a feat on his part. But the burden of holding the position between London and Cairo fell upon Alexander, and he carried that burden. Also, he devoted himself. He and McCreary devoted themselves to making sure that the Eighth Army was provided with every possible resource that was available to make the army more efficient. So in those two respects, Alexander made a tremendous contribution, and the two worked together harmoniously at that time. Later on, it broke down. I think Monty, there was maybe... Alex was never jealous of Monty, but I think Monty was jealous of Alex. But up to the launching of the Alamein offensive, I say launching because there was a time later on when Dick McCreary, under Alex's direction, intervened or tried to intervene in Monty's plan, Monty's action. The action at Alamein towards the end, the launch of Operation Supercharge. I've already spoken about, told you about the influence, the bad influence, I think, that Dorman Smith had Auchinleck. And I think it did. It was a very bad influence, and it did colour Auchinleck's performance. Also, I think he was a man, in my judgment, Auchinleck was a man of the highest integrity and courage. But he was not a great tactician, and he was not a great battlefield leader. In fact, if you look at Nigel Nicholson's biography of Alexander, you will find he quotes me as having said, having asked me whether Winston was right in attacking Auchinleck, and I said yes, because he'd run out of steam. That was partly the answer. And then Nicholson said, but surely he halted Rommel's advance short of the Delta. And I said yes, more by guts than by skill. So that's my assessment.
So you would have reacted then favourably to this changeover when Alexander and Montgomery came out?
Well, I certainly, I didn't know Alexander, but once I got to know him, I did, yes. But I did know Monty, as I told you, I'd been taught by him at South College, that did encourage me tremendously, the fact that he'd taken over 8th Army.
You've mentioned the Battle of El Alamein,
yes.
But before then, I believe there was another battle, was there not?
Al Halfa, yes.
I wonder if you could tell us, you know, what you know of that battle.
Well, I don't know an awful lot about it, but it's a controversy. Controversial because Dorman Smith claims that the Battle of Alam Halfa was planned and fought on the plan that he had formulated while he was still there. Well, I don't know whether that's true or not. I wouldn't take part in that argument. All I do know is that, in my opinion, it's always very difficult to pinpoint the responsibility, if you like to call it that, of the conception. But what really matters is the execution of a plan. And what happened really was that Rommel was clearly preparing for a further offensive. And the position was that the front at El Alamein was held by the infantry. On the north, it was the Australians and New Zealanders and so on. It was held by infantry divisions with the armour in support, and the armour on the left, with most of the armour on the left flank. And there's a feature which runs back from El Alamein, almost at right angles to it, which overlooks the line of advance that the German armour would have to take in order to break through into the delta. And Monty and De Gangor with Jorrocks and Tip Roberts organized a defense on that high ground which overlooked the open area which Rommel would have to face. And they put the armor in position, and Rommel had to attack and defeat that before he could safely continue his advance on the delta. And that was the Battle of Alam Halfa. It was really as if you had your right hand holding the front like that, with your left hand held back like that, overlooking the area, the line in which the German advance would have to take place. And they stood their ground, the Germans attacked them, and they defeated them. If they tried to do as they had done at Gazala and fight the German armour in the open, they would probably have been beaten.
Were the 44th Division, did they fight in that battle?
They fought in that battle, yes. They were on the southern flank of the general front, of the front, of the defensive front.
So they were...
They were, yes. Monty did use them, one brigade. He did use one brigade for a local counterattack, but they got badly mauled.
Yes, was he criticised for that, do you know?
Well, I don't know. I would have criticised him, but I wasn't in a position to do so.
But he was well aware that you considered them untrained.
Well, I must have been. I tell him so on the telephone, so I think he must have been. The false tour... Rommel's breakthrough, and it was, I think, it was it wasn't a big show, you know. It was a brigade attack. I think it was a mistake, and certainly that brigade of the 44th Division, which was commanded by a chap called Panty Robertson, who was a very good officer. And he was very severely wounded in that attack, counterattack. They weren't really fit for him. And that's my opinion. And you may be wrong. Anybody can be wrong.
How important do you think Montgomery's impact was on the Eighth Army and on the battle situation at that time?
His impact was tremendous. Oh, yeah, tremendous. Because he made it quite clear, just from the very beginning, that there was to be no further withdrawal. The army would stand and fight where it was. And he prepared the army for that. And the posture he took up and the position that he organized for the Battle of Alum Helfer.
did that have an immediate effect on morale, did you find?
Oh, yes, tremendous. I mean, it's the way you talk to people. He went round, he saw everybody, they saw him, and he told them what was what, and what they had to do, and why. And this is the way to get morale going the right way.
Yes, you were talking about that earlier on, about his tactics at Staff College.
Yeah.
And the importance of having contact with the troops, he was really practicing what he preached.
He was brilliant at carrying people with him by explaining to them what was going to happen, what he planned, and then, of course, by carrying it out.
And did he do that at all levels? Did he get right down to the men themselves, do you think?
Well, yes. What he did was, you see, before Alamein, for example, he went round to every division and talked to all the officers of a division, maybe brigade groups or something like that. And then they were responsible for passing that on to their soldiers. So the whole thing went right down from the top to the bottom. And there was a line of communications from the army commander to the last joined private soldier. I think it was, of course I knew about the plans for, not in detail, but the general plans for Alamein, Battle of Alamein, and I think it must have been in early September. I think that I was sent for by Alex, who said, Monty's asked you to go out and take over command of 7th Armored Division, so you'll have to go. And that was it. I was delighted and thrilled, of course. I mean, the great thing is command. I've been up and down the desert. I've been staff officer to 7 different generals. I'd seen all sorts of things happen, but I hadn't had a command since I had given up command of the 1st Battalion of my regiment. So it was tremendous for me. You know, I went out, I was rather frightened.
You were taking on the desert rats, I think.
Yes. I knew them very well, but I was very frightened all the same.
Is that so?
Yeah. Well, it's a terrific responsibility. I mean, I hadn't commanded a brigade. So, it was very, very anxious. Anxious is probably a better word than frightened.
Did you feel differently once you were at the front with them?
Well, no, I remained anxious for quite a long time, I think. Not until we really got going in the pursuit that I really feel, you know, it was all right. I had a brilliant G1 in Mike Carver and an excellent Q and a very, very good staff, and that's what carries you. And a really top class Armoured Brigade commander in Pip Roberts. So I had all of it, all that you need to make a success of it, provided I could do it.
How did you set about sort of establishing yourself with the men in the division?
Going around and talking to them, meeting them, talking to them, finding out what they thought about things and how they were and what their problems were. We spend all the time doing that. All the daytime, anyway, all the daylight hours. You certainly not compared with people like Jorrocks or Oliver Leese or Pip Roberts or a lot of them.
So could you tell me now, by the time you went to the 7th Armoured Division, I imagine the preparations for El Alamein were underway, is that right?
Yes, they were well underway. Yes, they were underway. Actually, the detailed plan for the division's role had to be worked out. And
were you aware of this pressure which was being put on Montgomery to bring it forward?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think I was at that. I had been while I was at GHQ, of course, but I don't think I was then. I mean, one always knows that the people in London always want things done the day before yesterday.
Yes, I understand that through Ultra, they had heard that during, I think it was August, Rommel was very short of supplies and felt that this would be a good time to press him.
I think that probably was so, yes.
But you still feel Montgomery was right, do you, Lord Hardinge, to hold back?
Oh, yes. You must never launch troops into battle unless they're properly prepared for it. Never. That is a crime. To launch troops into battle before they are properly prepared, well, as well prepared as they can possibly be made, with the resources available, then it is a wrong. It is wrong. Absolutely wrong.
So what preparations were made for that battle? Can you remember
the things you had to deal with? Extensive, of course. I mean, the question of reconnaissance, patrolling, getting more and more reconnaissance, ground reconnaissance, preparations for artillery bombardment by geometrical methods and all that sort of thing. A provision of building up of ammunition stocks to the required level, the actually briefing of commanders and staffs about their responsibilities, the whole of the reception plan, which was a very extensive one, everything like that.
Your experience must have come in very useful at this time. Did you find that, the fact that you'd had 18 months active campaigning in the desert?
Well, I don't know about being conscious. I mean, I'd grown into it, you see. I suppose I had grown into it, yes. I was short of knowledge and experience in some ways, but fairly experienced in others. Yeah.
How about the minefields? Were these going to prove a big worry?
They were very wild. They were the devil, yes. My job, you see, the 7th Armoured Division was on the south flank, the left flank, and the task that I was given was be to launch an attack against the enemy's position on my front, that is, on working up from the south, from Hemimet, which was a particularly awkward feature, northwards, and to launch that attack primarily to hold the German armor, I think it was 21st Panzer, down there and prevent them from being able to be moved north to take part and holding the main offensive, which was to take place in the north. So I was told personally by Monty to launch that offensive. Your job is to hold, to keep 21 Armed Panda down here by offensive action, but at the same time to keep your division in being so that it can take part in a further offensive in pursuit or whatever later on. So it was up, you know, heads you win, tails I lose.
What was so awkward about Himeimat?
Himeimat is a big feature. It was well defended by the Germans. It offered lend itself for readily for defence, and the approach to Himeimat was over very heavy sand, along a pretty long stretch of very heavy sand. And I had the French brigade.
Would that have slowed you down, the heavy sand? Mean that you would sink into
yes,
it?
Yes, very much so. And you couldn't get your support weapons forward, you see, so quickly, and artillery couldn't move forward. Well, not to, no, they took them much longer. It was a slower job altogether, and even the infantry found it going very tough. No, it slowed everything down, heavy sand. But the approach was of a fairly open stretch of ground from our position over an open stretch of ground towards this biggish feature, which was strongly held.
And I suppose you were coming
under... And then the minefields fell in the northern part. We had the chance was to get through the minefield in order to attack the enemy. And that was what caused us the most trouble. Once you get stuck in the minefield with your tanks, are dead ducks to the enemy anti-tank fire.